Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam. Tato Jayam Udirayet. Nasta Prayeshvabhadreshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavati Uttama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. This morning we're reading from the first canto, chapter 8, text 20. Before we start, I would just like to thank Vaishnava Prabhu for printing my little book here, Glorification of Srila Prabhupada, All That Lies Between. And I'm donating a copy for the library if anyone would like to see it. It's also available online. Or if you'd like copies, they're available for $500 a piece. All right, $5. Okay, so anyone like to take this to the library? Okay, thank you. So the subject this morning is the relative intelligence of men and women. And this is a verse by Queen Kunti. The situation is that Kunti Devi is just approaching Lord Krishna, who is just on the verge of leaving. The battle of Kurukshetra is over. Yudhisthira has been enthroned. The Kurus have been defeated. And Ashwatthama has been chastised. Right? So everything is done. And now Krishna is getting on his chariot to go back to Dwarka. And Kunti approaches him in this very helpless mood, really asking him to stay longer. So this is the second or third, one of the first of her prayers. Third prayer. Tita paramahamsanam munina mamalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartham katam pashyemahi striyaha tata paramahamsanam meenam amalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartham katam pashyemahi striyaha. Please chant.
Tata paramahamsanam
munina mamalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartam katam pashyema hi striyah. Munina mamalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartam katam pashyema hi striyah. Tata paramahamsanam munina mamalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartam katam pashyema hi striyah. Tata paramahamsanam munina mamalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartam katam pashyema hi striyah. Kita paramahamsanam munina mamalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartam katam bhashema hi striyah. Anyone else?
Tata paramahamsanam mamalatmanam bhakti yoga vidhanartham kritam pashye mahistriyah.
Okay, let's read the synonyms together, please. Tata, besides that, paramahamsanam, of the advanced transcendentalists, muninam, of the great philosophers or mental speculators, amala atmanam, though those whose minds are competent to discern between spirit and matter, bhakti yoga, the science of devotional service, vidhanartham, for executing, katam, how, for shema, can observe, he, certainly, striyaha, women. Translation. You yourself descend to propagate the transcendental science of devotional service under the hearts of the advanced transcendentalists and mental speculators who are purified by being able to discriminate between matter and spirit. How then can we women know you perfectly? Purport. Who would like to read? Anyone? About my candy?
Even the greatest philosophical speculators cannot have access to the region of the Lord. It is said in the Upanishads that the Supreme Truth, the Absolute Personality of Godhead, is beyond the range of thinking power of the greatest philosopher. He is unknowable by great learning or by the greatest brain. He is knowable only by one who has his mercy. Others may go on thinking about him for years together, yet he is unknowable. This very fact is corroborated by the queen, who is playing the part of an innocent woman. Women in general are unable to speculate like philosophers, but they are blessed by the Lord because they believe at once in the superiority and almightiness of the Lord, and thus they offer obeisances without reservation. The Lord is so kind that he does not show special favor only to one who is a great philosopher. He knows the sincerity of purpose. For this reason, only women generally assemble in great number in any sort of religious function. In every country and in every sect of religion, it appears that the women are more interested than the men. This simplicity of acceptance of the Lord's authority is more effective than showy insincere religious fervor.
Thank you. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So there's a story about the blind man and the elephant. Five blind men were brought into a room where there was an elephant, and they all attempted to understand what was this creature before them. So one of them embraced his legs and said, "Oh, the elephant is like a tree." And one of them patted the side and said, "Oh, the elephant is like a wall." Another one flapped his ear and said, "No, the elephant is like a curtain." Another one pulled his tail and said, "The elephant is like a rope." The other one had his trunk and said, "No, the elephant is like a hose." You know, so everybody had their perception of the thing, but they could not see the whole thing. So Prabhupada suggested that we study issues from various angles of vision in order to get a comprehensive view of the whole question. And that's what I would like to do this morning for class. The topic is, are women less intelligent than men? And we're going to examine this question first philosophically, then socially, then scientifically, then politically, and finally in your personal spiritual life. Is that all right? All right, so maybe if we all feel this question in different ways, we'll come to some kind of overview. So the first and most important way to evaluate this issue is philosophically. So we have statements in Prabhupada's books and in the Bhagavad Gita that indicate a difference between men and women, or between highly evolved men and women, in terms of their philosophical abilities. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, "Striyo vaishyas tata sudras te piyanti param gatim." Even people of lower birth, he actually uses this phrase, papayonaya, sinful birth, can approach the supreme destination. Then he enumerates Striya, women, Vaishyas, merchants, Tata, Sudras, and Sudras, the worker class. Now, that score one for the men, right? There's our verse. this phrase, less intelligent, Prabhupada uses in reference to this verse from time to time in his purports. So we see also in the Bhagavatam that Kalau Sudra Sambhava, in Kali Yuga, everyone is born less than a Sudra. So some Kali Yuga man is pointing to this verse from Bhagavad Gita and saying, therefore I am more intelligent than women. He should also read the other verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. See, that the Shudra class is in the same category as the women class. And this is all in the context of a fully blossomed Varnashram Vedic civilization. Okay? So that is where this origin of discrimination or apparent discrimination comes up from the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita. Now, also in the Bhagavad Gita, in an earlier chapter, we find a much more relevant and pertinent philosophical point. And that is from the beginning of the teachings of Lord Krishna. He is explaining to Arjuna that the soul is not the body. So the soul being not the body, therefore in the fifth chapter we find that a learned person sees with equal vision not only different genders, but different species. Vidya Vinaya. Vidya means knowledge, Vinaya, the one who is endowed with knowledge. Sampane can see with equal vision. Brahmane Gavi Hashtani. A high-class Brahmin, an elephant, a cow, a shune chaiva, a dog, and swapake cha, even the person who eats dogs. Pandita samadarshana. Truly learned person does not discriminate even between these vastly different categories. So when we speak of women being less intelligent, or we read about this, what is that degree, first of all, of less intelligent? Is it 100% versus 99%? I mean, in the classroom, right, somebody might be rated first at 100% and second at 99%. So is there really that much of a difference? but Srila Prabhupada specifically said to his female disciples and followers that if somebody thinks they are a woman, they are less intelligent. So if a man is thinking, yes, I am more intelligent than women, then he's less intelligent. And yet we read that Kunti is saying to Krishna, well, how can you come for the great philosophers, the great munis? How can we know, we simple women, know you perfectly? So, of course, this is actually a very elevated Vaishnava statement, because that's the quality of the Vaishnava. They don't see, oh, Krishna, I'm so qualified, you should show yourself to me. They say, Krishna, I'm so unqualified, but in spite of that, you're so merciful. That is the truly realized Vaishnava. We talk about self-realization, and it sounds like a really exotic, far-out thing, but it, in fact, means seeing all the warts, all the anartas, all the unwanted things in our lives. Then we're getting realized. When we see the ugly things, then we're getting an actual glimpse of reality. See? So this is Kunti's humble prayer, saying, presenting herself on behalf of her gender as disqualified. So how can we know you perfectly, she's saying. Now, those are some philosophical considerations of this question. We can understand, first of all, that we are not these bodies. If somebody is seeing on the basis of the body, then they're less intelligent. And secondly, we can understand that any intelligent or any sincere Vaishnava will look not at their qualifications, but their disqualifications in approaching the Lord. So Krishna is very accepting of everyone and very encouraging of everyone. So any questions on the philosophical side of this issue? Any other discussions or points anyone would like to make? Okay. All right, so let's, yes?
Can you just clarify how the males should see the women if they're not supposed to see them as women? Like, because you mentioned that if you see them as women, then they're okay. Less intelligent.
You are skipping to part 5, which is the personal spiritual side of the question. So we'll get to that, okay? But it's a very important point you raise. Any other philosophical questions? Okay, so we understand this basic philosophy. So then let's move on to the social considerations of this issue. And I'm speaking now in broad terms of the greater society. It's first of all important to contextualize Srila Prabhupada in terms of where he is coming from, because this issue in Prabhupada's books is a very sensitive issue in our society. A few years ago, the devotees in BBT in Sweden are doing a website update, and they had a section called Tough Ones, like controversial things from Prabhupada's books. So they asked various devotees to comment on, and they happened to ask me to comment on this particular subject about Prabhupada's statements about women. So I decided to answer it subjectively and just say that, you know, from my experience being married for 30 years plus and having two daughters, that I see clearly the distinctions in intelligence between men and women, the different natures. Prabhupada also alludes to this in his purport, that he's actually speaking that the advanced transcendentalists that Kunti refers to, the great mental speculators, can never know Krishna. But simple women who tend to come in larger numbers to spiritual functions, they can know him much more easily. So there is this distinction. But our society acts to remove distinctions or sees that as a noble progressive step. Does anyone remember when we had Dr. Merritt here 2 years ago, Jim Merritt from the Metropolitan Christian Church here in town? Anyway, he summarized his theology in 3 points: gay liberation, racial liberation, and women's liberation. This is his idea of Christianity, is his realization. In other words, social equality was, to him, the highest spiritual principle. Now, Srila Prabhupada he grew up in Victorian India, which is a rather patriarchal society, not only with the British influence, but with the Hindu tradition and the Muslim influence in particular. Some of my learned godbrothers argue that the whole idea of women covering the head is a Muslim tradition, not a Hindu tradition. You know, I don't know, but they have evidence to that effect. But Prabhupada wrote about his mother never leaving the home unless she was in a palanquin, you know, covered very chastely. His father arranged his marriage. These are things that are functions of a more patriarchal society. So when Prabhupada writes about or makes comments like this, they strike us in our society as being extremely backwards, and yet they're perfectly normal in the society from which he is coming. So this is not to relativize Prabhupada's teachings. Prabhupada's teachings are absolute. But it is important to understand that he could say things comfortably in his context that would not be comfortable in our context. So if we're interested in following Prabhupada, then we should not just parrot him and say things that we know are going to offend people around us, right? Is this a nice service? But Prabhupada said. But we should have enough intelligence to appropriately present Prabhupada's teachings. For example, just staying on the point, you're not this body, is perfectly fine. And then that's a simple antidote. Well, it says in his books that women are less intelligent, but he also says you're not this body. So this is for people who are on the bodily platform. Okay, and everybody who thinks they're not this body is less intelligent. So socially, there's this context to consider. Now, it was very interesting in the 70s when Prabhupada was preaching very broadly in the United States, because Dr. Merritt's social movement of women's liberation was a big thing at that time. I was born in the Leave It to Beaver days of the 1950s when mom was always at home, dad was always at work. You know, mom's baking cookies, dad's coming home after work and playing basketball with the boys. You know, this was the social ideal. So by the time the 70s had come around, there was a lot of social turmoil. And one very strong segment of society was saying, and women are being discriminated against, and they should be equal. And they have plenty of proof, and it's still current, that a woman will receive less money for the same job than a man is doing. So in other words, they have the same title, the same responsibilities, but a man will be paid more than a woman. And that gap is narrowing, but it still exists. But it was really big back then. And women were excluded from many professions. So part of the women's liberation movement was for this social equality. Another part was for sexual freedom. In other words, any taboos about contraception should be removed so that women could have control over their reproduction. And this was part of the women's liberation movement. They ought to, just like men could go around and have sex with whomever they could convince to do so, so women should also have that freedom. And women should not be expected to, therefore, be modest in public. They should be free to dress any way they wanted. So this women's liberation was a hot social issue in the 70s. And Prabhupada had a lot of fun with it. Okay? He, first of all, exposed it, I thought very brilliantly, by saying the women's liberation movement is a plot by the men so they can sexually exploit the women and get them to do more work. So that was something that nobody else said. But doesn't that resonate? You know, it's a plot by the men. That was his summary of it. And then he would speak very frankly that women are less intelligent than men. So there was this article in the Chicago Tribune, I believe the paper is called, written by a reporter who came to his press conference. And she began the article by saying, if this article has poor grammar and a lot of faults, it's because it's written by a less intelligent woman. You could surmise that she was not pleased by Prabhupada's speaking. So it was controversial, but Prabhupada was not afraid of controversy. In fact, he said that the proof that you're spreading Krishna consciousness is that some people become agitated. If you never do anything, no one will ever criticize you. So if you don't want to be criticized, all you have to do is don't do anything. But if you do something, you can expect to be criticized. So he took it in that stride. But socially, it was a very controversial thing in that context of the external liberation of women. Now, from a philosophical point of view, of course, that women's liberation is completely on the bodily platform. The Vaishnav says everybody should be liberated. Everyone can be liberated. So men, women, whatever. And what is liberation? Having freedom for more sense gratification and economic development in society? No, that's just the dog chasing its tail. It's just a repetitive sequence of birth and death and enjoyment in between, right? Or false attempt at enjoyment. So real liberation means to end that whole cycle. And anyone is eligible for that. And as we've discussed before, when Prabhupada arrived in America and he understood the social context of the people with whom he was dealing, he immediately made concessions or liberalizations that were unheard of in India, specifically to allow women to live in the ashram and to create ashrams for women. You have to understand that these ashram, to live in a temple, an ashram, is pretty much for renunciates. Whoa. Sorry, that was the exact side I put up. So, only men and only renounced men would live in temples, see, in the Gaudiya Math. That was it. So the idea of a brahmacharini ashram was unheard of. Women were to be always, they'd live with their parents, and then they would get married and live with their husbands, and then when they're older, they would live with their son. This was the social norm. So therefore, what's the need? But in America, Prabhupada saw that boys and girls were living together. They were living independently of their parents. They were economically independent. So And they were also approaching him. And he, in response to his critics, he said, what am I supposed to do? These nice young ladies want to be Krishna conscious. I'm supposed to tell them no because of your material body? So he wrote in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that my godbrothers criticize, but we are spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world, men and women, brothers and sisters standing together, speaking, teaching Krishna consciousness, and my godbrothers who are criticizing can do nothing. So this is the social context of this issue. There's a conservative social and a liberal social understanding of it. Both of them are really externals and material. Okay? The real, if you want to judge Prabhupada on this issue, judge him on what he did, which is liberalize the teaching of Krishna consciousness to everybody. Okay, so any questions or points about the social aspects of this question? Okay, right. Then let's move on to the scientific considerations. What is the actual science? When he was teasing people, teasing these ladies in the 70s, Prabhupada used to quote his professor Farquhar, a psychology teacher from Scottish Church's College. It was almost 100 years ago now when he was in college. This Professor Farquhar, who was a Scotsman and one of the prominent teachers at his school, taught in the psychology class that women's brains are smaller than men's. He said man's brains can be up to 64 ounces, women's brains 36 ounces maximum. So Prabhupada would quote Professor Farquhar and in making this statement. This, in fact, was a gender bias that existed about 100 years ago that has subsequently been disproven by modern science. Okay. Modern science has evaluated the brain size of women and of men in which they could find one, and found that they are identically sized in proportion to the bodily size, okay, to the weight, to the body, the body's weight. The brain will be of equal proportion. So there really is no physical difference as far as size is concerned. But they also have found that the way men's and women's brains are entirely different, are entirely different. men's brains, they have studies of areas of the brain that are activated, and they compare the same stimulus for men and women. So like reading a novel. So when hearing a novel, a man's brain lights up on the, I think it's the left side only. A woman's brain lights up on the left and the right side. So both sides, both hemispheres are activated. And this is the consistent pattern with women's brains as compared to men's brains. Men's brains are highly focused on, I believe it's the left side, which is the rational, abstract, mathematical, linguistic. These are the kind of strengths of male intelligence. And female intelligence is balanced between the abstract and the emotional. So the emotional intelligence lends itself well to community building, negotiations, to peacemaking, to stability, and what am I trying to say? Regularity. These things are strengths on the women's side. So in children, educators have observed that little boys will like to learn how things work, and they'll want to tear them apart, and this will captivate their intelligence, generally speaking. Little girls will be captivated by the social experience of going to school and interacting with many people and making friends and also creating fantasy worlds with dolls, family settings. These are the things that captivate the little girl's brain. As boys and girls age, other differences emerge. Women will speak an average of 25,000 words a day. Men, an average of 10,000 words a day. And that is an evidence, actually, of their better skills as communicators. And the women's nature calls for being understood. Women want to be understood. Men want to do stuff. Okay, there's a really hilarious article in this by Dave Barry, comedian writer, that I'd love to read for you, but it probably would be inappropriate for this class. But if anyone would like to see it, I'll send it to you. It's the best distilled distinction between men and women I have ever read. But anyway, suffice it to say, science has proven that men's and women's brains function differently. That is the actual modern evidence. Okay, the brain size is not an issue. So men tend to excel in fields that that call for rational, abstract thought, such as mathematics, etc. No, it is not limited by any means. And more, it doesn't mean that a woman cannot do these things equally well or better. But it's just the general tendency will not be in that direction for women. Similarly, men have a harder time communicating. I mean, it's almost it's a cliche, isn't it, to think of some man who's really good at something or has a lot of money or something, but he can't set down his ego for like even 2 minutes to give himself a break, you know? But he's got to be recognized, got to be appreciated, and drags around this gigantic ego, cannot separate his abilities from his need to be recognized and to be appreciated, which is clearly a sign of emotional immaturity, right? It's not necessary for human beings to be admired by everybody in order to function. You know? But men have emotional handicaps in this way, where if they're not appreciated and recognized, they don't feel fulfilled. This, again, as Prabhupada alludes in the purport, women can be naturally more humble, and that comes much more easily to women. I always like to give my own sociological observation or scientific observation of the Alachua temple room during a kirtan on the Sunday feast. On the ladies' side, they're doing these lotuses, folding and opening and closing, you know, as they gracefully circle and all these elaborate patterns. And the men are having a jumping contest. Right? Who can jump? And the best you can get from the men's side is a circle. The men can go in a circle because every one of them thinks they're leading it. Okay. This is actually emotional immaturity. From a spiritual point of view, it's a great handicap. Now, from a spiritual point of view, it is a great asset if the men can memorize verses, can maybe understand nuances of philosophy more easily. You know, my wife is forever berating me because I know a few more verses than she does, and I can learn them fairly easily, and she struggles with them. She stomps her feet and curses providence. No, she doesn't. But on the other hand, she can understand much better than I how people are feeling. And so I've learned to ask her, so what's going on with this? What is your perception? And she gives me insights that I find very helpful. So scientifically, the brains function in different ways. That we should know. There is, therefore, a basis for discrimination. Not saying one's better than the other, but saying clearly they are different types of intelligences. All right, any comments on the science? Yes? Can we pass the mic? It's all right. Not only broadcast, it's being recorded and translated into many languages. But go ahead.
Okay. So this is kind of related to what you just spoke about and the last segment as well. You know, you're talking about how men need to be recognized and appreciated, and then women are better at understanding feelings and communicating. So it makes a lot of sense that, you know, a man would go earn the livelihood for the family, and the woman can understand his feelings, his needs to be appreciated and recognized for that. And she can also relate to the children and understand their needs, even though they can't communicate
yet.
They can't speak their needs very well. She can say, oh, this little girl just needs a hug. And the man can say, why is she being such a brat?
Yes.
You know? So it makes a lot of sense to me that a woman would stay home with the children and a man would earn the living. And I feel like a big negative to the women's liberation movement is that families are falling apart because men are not being appreciated, their needs are not being met, and women, their needs are not being met because, you know, they're pushing themselves to be equal to men in the workforce, mm-hmm. instead of being happy with their roles as, you know, caregivers, and, you know, that they can communicate with the children and, mm-hmm. and meet the needs of their husband through appreciating them. And I see a lot of other bad things about it, such as, you know, abortion increasing and all of this. And but the one good thing that I know about it, as far as I understand, it's related to laws changing about men no longer having the right to beat their wives. It used to be acceptable under the laws that mm-hmm. know, there was nothing a woman could do to mm-hmm. avoid that kind of
right.
thing. So anyway, that's all.
All of this, yes, these are very good points. When I answered that question for BBT, I made similar points, that it's not every woman, but most women will be inclined, at least at some point in their lives, to have a domestic situation and raise children. And men who are decent will fund that, you know. I was speaking with my friend Toshan Prabhu, who's the retired now principal of the charter school in Alachua. And at one time, there was a girls' ashram there in Alachua, but no boys' ashram. So I had my daughters in the girls' ashram, I said, yeah, it's a shame we don't have one for the boys. He said, no, the boys don't need an ashram. Really? He said, no, the boys need to go to public school and learn how to compete. But the girls need to learn Krishna consciousness and inculcate it so they can pass it on to their children. So that culture actually lives in the house. And that is the domain of the ladies. So I thought that was a very salient point. Huh? But in the Kali Yuga, the people will take it any advantage to feel themselves superior. But I appreciated very much what you said. You were describing a functional marriage and a functional family. So we'll go into that a little bit more in a minute here. Okay? All right. Anything else on the scientific side?
I'm not positive which category this falls in, so maybe I can ask it and you can answer at the appropriate. But I'm wondering what your opinion and comments would be on the university system right now, because my sister is at school in Oregon, my brother works at a university in California, and I went to school in New York, and all three had the problem of, like, many, many, many more women in the population of the university than men. And working at the university, my brother, that's actually a function of his job, is to try to recruit more men. My sister is at a school right now where 70% are women.
Wow.
And I know that's it's a very strong trend that's happening, so I wondered what you think
about that. That is really a social phenomenon, partly an outcome of this move for equality from the 70s. And it has overextended. I think that is an interesting observation that speaks for itself. I don't really have anything to add. We have just a few more minutes. I'd like to finish up these other two categories. The next, because these are the touchier ones, let's talk about the political implications. And I'm now talking not about the greater society, but about ISKCON and the Society Association of Devotees. So in the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there are examples of women taking top spiritual roles. But it is controversial now in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, because in some more conservative parts of the world, they're adamantly opposed to women taking the service of giving diksha. Okay? So I'm going to just focus on that for the sake of this practical discussion. It's a controversy that exists in other religious organizations. Now, a lot of people just eschew religious organizations for this very reason, because they don't want controversy. But the benefits of having a society of devotee are many, and you know them well. So then the debt we have to pay is to keep things organized and deal with different points of view and different opinions. So in our society, the highest spiritual responsibility is giving initiation, initiating people into the Sampradaya. There are equivalent, philosophically equivalent responsibilities in terms of giving someone instructions and teaching them about Krishna consciousness. So the Shastra says that both these types of spiritual duties are equal. But in practice, there are many people who teach and very few who initiate. And that's another discussion, why that is so, and how I hope that can be changed in the future. But one of the ways it could be changed is to allow women to give initiation. So this is a very, again, right now it's a very controversial point, because the very conservative temples in parts of the world happen to be doing very well right now. And the areas of the world where things like this would be much more advantageous for us in our presentation, like in the West, we're more in a struggling position. Okay? We're just doing our best to push on and try to expand the movement. In India specifically, you open a temple, it's like printing money, and people are so happy, and they're building enormous temples. The president of India comes to open them, and huge projects. I mean, it would blow you away if you haven't seen them. So the Indian temples tend to say, well, this is against the Vedic culture, okay, that women should initiate. But it's a very difficult argument to make, because Prabhupada was asked and answered this question very specifically, that, yes, women could give initiation. He said, not so many, but some. And that is the history of our lineage, that there are not a lot of women who are initiating, but there were some. So at present, it is officially allowed, but every time a woman has come up to take this service, the GBC has objected. And not the entire body, but enough members to make it very divisive. So I was reading recently about the Anglican Church, the Church of England, which is the forerunner of the Episcopalian Church here in America. And the same controversy exists. Women are now priests, which is a certain level of spiritual responsibility, but they're not allowed to be bishops. And there are many people within the church who say, if women become bishops, we're leaving. And indeed, whole congregations have just pulled out of the organization over this issue. So I was speaking with Sesha Prabhu about this before he was going to the meeting, and he said, yeah, they're just trying to finesse it, trying to be patient. The fact is that the arguments against women initiating are totally on the bodily platform. And there are, there's nothing substantial in Prabhupada's books to substantiate that argument, whereas he said directly that they could. So you can see it's a very tough argument that they've got. But the GBC is trying to be patient. So that's one of the realities of this politically. Anyone know the meaning of politics? Simple definition? Who gets what, when, and where? That's what politics means. Who gets what, when, and where? So right now, women officially have the right, but in practice have not yet been established as initiating gurus. Anytime it could happen, I hope this year. But that's the political considerations. And specifically in Krishna House, in our personal spiritual life, I'd like to just go right into that. This is the most important thing to me, about how you all can progress in Krishna consciousness, be happy in Krishna consciousness, stay in Krishna consciousness, and not fall into maya. Okay? Because it's a happy life. It's a nice life to remain. Wouldn't you agree? Are you happy being devotees? Is he enjoying yourself? So would you like to die devotees? I don't mean today, but I mean at some point. So it's a long haul between here and there. What is going to work in this area of gender balance for you? So Prabhupada said, and the Shastra also says, the women are like fire and men are like butter. So women are actually more powerful than men. It's like fire is more powerful than butter, because women can bring men under their control. Yeah. And the interesting thing is that what do we find in a Vedic sacrifice? What must be there in every Vedic sacrifice? Fire and butter, right? You need them both. So if you just try to throw the butter in the fire, well, it flames up and it can actually be very dangerous and it can make a mess. But if you add the skillet, you can put the butter over the fire and then you can control and use it very nicely, right? Then the fire and the butter work together to make nice halva or something else. So the Grihastha ashram is like that skillet that enables the fire and butter to function together for a productive purpose. And without the skillet, it's a mess. Right? So you try to use butter in the kitchen without a skillet, what will you do? So 99% of people who make it in Krishna consciousness will get married at some point in their lives, in their spiritual lives. Some are natural single people, men and women. They just really are content without being married, and they are prepared to do without it for their whole life. And they're comfortable with that. That is, it's a very important skill to learn when you're young, how to live peacefully without intimate association with the opposite gender. That is brahmacharya training. And that is so helpful for life because then you know you can live without it if you must. Otherwise, the attachment is so strong that it's hard to think how you can function without a partner. And that is a strong illusion. Now, in the Shastra, there's very strong statements criticizing householder life. In the beginning of the second canto, when Sukadeva Goswami finally gets to speak, first thing out of the gate, right, is, what is that verse? Pashyanapi na pashyati. Deha patra kala tradishu, thank you. Deha patra kala tradishu, atma sanyeshva satsvapi. Tesham pramata nidhanam pashyanapi na pashyati. The materialistic householder thinks his body, his wife, his family, they're going to protect him. But they are fallible soldiers and they can't. And even though they've experienced this life after life after life, still they can't see what's really going on. So householder life or married life without Krishna consciousness is heavily criticized. However, if we misunderstand those statements and apply them to Krishna conscious householder life, then we commit offenses to nice devotees. It's certainly a fact that single celibate life is 100 times simpler and easier for making spiritual advancement than the complications of married life. But married life is more sustainable. So if you can get to the platform of being able to be peaceful as a householder and stay married for a long time, your chances of going back to Godhead increase exponentially. So it's, to me, a very integral part of your spiritual training to understand, to respect householder life, to be realistic about yourself, to understand the dangers of inappropriate association, to get help if you want to get married, you know, to get some guidance from senior devotees, especially people who've been successful in being married for a long time. If you feel like you got to go out and try to attract somebody or impress somebody, that's Maya. It just is not going to be the basis for a good relationship. But if you get some guidance and some support, and there's fortunately plenty available for you here, then this is a mature and good move for keeping yourself in Krishna consciousness. If you're happy being single, don't worry about it. But don't be down on people who are getting married, or else you also will fall down due to making offenses. Just like there's a temple president in the West Coast recently. You've been trained of brahmachari for many years, and then he became the president of his brahmachari temple, but then he fell in love. And then I can't stay in Krishna consciousness. Really a shame. It's a great shame, because he wasn't given the rounded training, you know. But yeah, you're likely going to want to be married, so just do it in a careful way, and you'll be able to navigate it. So it's difficult to be married because men and women think so differently. And it really takes a lot of sacrifice and surrender to make that yajna work. But it's built on mutual respect. If men think they're better than women, they are in big maya. You know, they don't understand. They just don't understand. It's a very immature attitude. And if women are feeling like second-class citizens in ISKCON, then they have poor leadership, and they're not getting the balanced guidance that they deserve and protection. So it is certainly difficult to manage your spiritual life in close association with so many nice men and nice women in one environment. So that's why the only thing that will save us is knowledge, is intelligence, and sincerity in wanting to please Guru and Krishna. Then it's possible, and very nice life awaits you if you can just navigate this one challenge. So that is my sermon on this subject. Do you know now who's more intelligent, men or women? Who? Any men want to chime in here? No, devotees are the most intelligent. That's it. Any comments or questions? Yes?
I have a question about what's the appropriate age range for marriage?
A good age range, that's a good question, and I'm just going to speak practically here. It's in the mid to late 20s. And the reason is that scientifically and also practically, that's when your personality is pretty much formed. Even biologically, the human brain does not finish forming until about that time.
But what if someone comes to Krishna consciousness much later in life?
That's all right. Each situation is individual. And if the partnership is right, you know, then such marriages can work. Generally, if a person can say, no, I've been there, done that, I'm in my 40s and I've had these, and you know, that's good. But if they can't do that, there are partners to find. The real point is how to remain in Krishna consciousness. And marriage can be very helpful for that. So ideally, yeah, mid-20s, mid to late 20s is a real good time. Okay. Other comments or questions? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. How to look at women.
If a man looks at a woman and thinks that she's a woman, he's being less intelligent.
Yes.
So then how then should a man look at a woman?
Look at a male devotee. Should look at a female devotee as a devotee. And how do devotees relate with each other? They serve each other. They appreciate each other. But what male and female devotees should not do is reveal their minds to each other unless they're married or going to be married. See, that is too intimate. If a woman comes to a male devotee, and says, I have this problem, Prabhu, could I tell you about it? Or if a man comes to a female devotee and says, Mataji, you know, could you give me some insight on this from a female point of view? It's mine. It's too close. Now, what if a male devotee is seeing female devotees maybe as their future Radharanis, you know? That means that a man needs to take the proper steps to plan to get married. In other words, if there's undue attraction or a great deal of attraction, that's a sign that one is ready to appropriately enter grihastha life. It's not a big disqualification. It should not be repressed. It should be dealt with properly, maturely, with help. Is that right? Okay. So, anything else? Last comments or questions? Was this helpful? Was it boring? Was it controversial? All right, well, thank you very much. Now, Thursday we have a class on spiritual marriage, so we'll get more into that. Pardon me? Srila Prabhupada ki jai.